I'm Ophira Eisberg from Ask Me Another. Every week we play nerdy games with contestants and celebrities. Hear Patrick Stewart dramatically read Taylor Swift lyrics or learn how many quills there are on a porcupine. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Ask anyone who's made a career out of making music, and they'll probably tell you the same thing. The first time you go on tour, it kind of stinks. I mean, sure, you're on a big long road trip with your friends, you're meeting new people, but you're also stuck in a messed up car for hours and hours and hours. You're sleeping on couches and floors. You're eating bananas, stale pita chips. Open Mike Eagle is a rapper, and for him, it was all that and more. He remembers the low point on his first tour, too. He just rolled up to Vancouver. He didn't really know anybody, and he needed a place to stay.
I, like, got a hotel on Hotels.com, and I was in a street called Hastings Street in Vancouver. Do you know about that place? You couldn't have told me it wasn't the meth capital of the world. These hotel rooms were not used for people sleeping. They were used for people to rent and do meth. Hotels.com didn't want to tell me that, though. They wanted me to give my money to this person. It was like, you want to sleep here? He was surprised.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, my conversation with Open Mike Eagle. He's done pretty well for himself since then. He's put out 6 records. He's been featured on a bunch more. He's got his own Comedy Central show coming up. The person who convinced him to go for it? His wife, dummy.
But yeah, she was like, no, you should just get on unemployment and try out the music thing. I was like, for real?
And take it from Mike. Don't be afraid to dream big.
I had a small goal. Well, I had actually a lofty goal of a television show getting in NPR, and that happened.
Yeah, Bullseye's where dreams come true. Then we've got comedian, writer, and NPR favorite Paula Poundstone on the movie that she wishes she'd made. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I guess you could call Open Mike Eagle a rapper on the rise, but it's been a really long, steady, unique rise. He was born in Chicago. He moved to L.A. later on. For the first part of his adult life, he was a teacher. He actually didn't release his first album until he was almost 30. In his rhymes, there's humor, which you see a lot in rap, but it's weirder and kind of self-deprecating at times, too. Like, the first album he put out was called Unapologetic Art Rap. Kind of a power play, right? Anyway, everything's coming up Eagle now. He co-hosts the podcast Tights and Fights. It's a wrestling podcast here at Max Fun. He's also just been given his first ever TV show by Comedy Central. That's in the works right now. Mike's latest album dropped a couple of weeks ago. It's called Brick Body Kids Still Daydream. It's really great. Let's take a listen to Brick Body Complex, the first single off the record.
Don't call me a rapper, my mother. My name is Michael Eagle, I'm sovereign, I'm from a line of ghetto superheroes. I holler, I got something to bring to your attention. Attention, 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 attention. I promise you I will never fit in your descriptions. I'm giant, don't let nobody tell you nothing different. They lying, a giant in my body is a building. A building, a building, a building. No surfaces underground, no sound when I'm calling home. City broken, my brothers down. Now I'm standing here all alone. Somewhere that my monochrome and my hollow.
Open Mike Eagle, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. I've been hovering around the show audio wise for a long time.
Well, I read an interview that you did maybe, I'm going to say, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the grand finale was you saying that you needed to get a TV show and an interview on NPR.
Yeah.
Well, you got a TV show and an interview on NPR.
Hey, that's good.
We just filled it in. Congratulations on the TV show.
Thanks. I need people to remind me of things I've said more so I can feel my growth that way.
It is a terrifying thing to try and get enough perspective on your own life to appreciate the fact that you are, for example, I mean, in your case, making a living and supporting a family in part.
Yeah.
by making music, for example.
Yeah, you know, I've been really good about being able to be very aware of that as a benchmark and a thing, especially since, like, you know, 70% of the guys I started with and I still see all the time haven't been able to make that transition. So, you know, it's not something that I lose sight of, but it's like it's not the financial ones. It's like the ones that actually make me feel better. Those are the ones I have to remember.
What are the ones that actually make you feel better?
Like that. Like, I had a small goal. Well, I had actually a lofty goal of a television show, getting an interview on NPR, and that happened. I'm like, oh, that's nice to think that I worked along my weird path and got to the places I was trying to go. Because I often end up, I have the bad thoughts a lot. Because I had a lot of weird expectations coming into making music and trying to sell it to people. I had a lot of weird expectations about where I would, how I would emerge into the marketplace and the culture. These very lofty, strange ideas. And, you know.
Well, I mean, I think that you have the disadvantage of emerging as a hip-hop artist at exactly the time that being an independent hip-hop artist was its most difficult.
Yeah,
I mean, you
terrible.
hear these stories about guys in 1999 just hanging out every day with a stack of 12 inches outside Fat Beats
sure.
Records, selling 100 12 inches a day while they stand there and freestyle and then making $100,000 a year or whatever.
Yeah, and I know a lot of those guys and those same guys. There were enough small independent rap labels in places like L.A. and the Bay and a few other places where these guys were also getting 30 grand advances 2-3 times a year to make albums. And all of that went away when people stopped buying physical media at the rate that they were.
So, Mike, you're very old to be a
it's true.
Hot young rapper.
It is so true.
So what is different about your career path from those guys that you were rapping with in, you know, 2002 or 2004 who have jobs now?
Well, even then I was old is one thing. The guys I was rapping with, you know, in the early aughts, like I had gone to college already. I already had a bachelor's degree even before I got out here and started really seriously making music. I had life, had a lot of life already. And so when I came into it, I knew that, you know, it took a lot of skill. It took a lot of acumen musically. And I didn't have all of that. I had the basics. I was a street corner rapper. I was a freestyle guy. I just didn't have anything to sell, but I was a freestyle on the corner, battle in the streets rapper. That's what I was raised in rap to be. But when I decided to try to understand how the career part of it worked, I was bringing the skill set of somebody who, you know, graduated university, really with no support, you know. So, like, me knowing how to email a person sensibly, you know, like, that actually put some distance between me and a lot of my peers, is that, like, I had the tiniest bit of organizational skills and could kind of see forward that way. I used to, I called it intern at a place called Project Bloat Records. Project Bloat, of course, being a long-running event. I know you were listening to some Freestyle Fellowship earlier today.
Remembering high school fondly.
Freestyle Fellowship, of course, being the founders of the Project Blow, the long-running open mic in L.A. that I moved here and kind of embedded myself in. But at that time, they also had a record label. They had an office like around the corner from where the event was held. And I would just go there all the time. Like, I had a day job. On my lunches, I would go to that office after work, any night that there were people around. I would just be in there constantly trying to, like, understand what the particular moves of an independent rapper was, if that was their career. Like, so they taught me how to call up Amoeba or Rasputin and get them to try to buy copies of the new album. And at that point, they were just taking things on consignment. Like, the market was already crashing. But they laid out all of those skills. I used to go on tour with guys and just do their merch, just so I could watch and see and understand how everything worked. So the organizational skills, and I think just me having a little bit more of a sense of pop culture outside of rap, I leaned on that pretty heavily too. in terms of my content.
I think a lot of people, especially in hip hop and, you know, in other kinds of pop music as well, if they're not a professional at 25,
right?
Huh? It's over.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, how old is Chance the Rapper? He's like 22 or something like that.
I have no idea how old any of those people are.
21, 22 years
old? All those young rich men have the oldest souls, and you can just see it in their eyes. I don't know. I don't. I am fascinated by what those people's lives must be, like their brains must be like.
But when you were 25, did you feel that way? Like, did you look around you and say, like, oh, a lot of these dudes getting signed are 19, and...
I never really looked at getting quote-unquote signed that way. Like, that was never really part of my path, was getting signed to, like, a major. Because that was always, especially when I was 25, there was zero room to be a weird rapper on that level. So I was following the path of independent artists who were already around. I was following Bus Driver and AC Alone and Abstract Root, like, literally following them on tour. You know, so I didn't feel the age thing then like I do now, because now the playing field is leveled in so many ways. The weirdness is leveled in so many ways that, like, age is a little bit more pronounced to me as a difference now than it was then. And also I keep getting older. So
let's hear some more music from my guest, Open Mike Eagle, and his brand new album, which is called Brick Body Kid Still Daydream. This is called 95 Radios.
And we drove all through the neighborhood, sitting in a car all day, trying to find a radio. And we wrapped both hands in tinfoil, pointed at the window frame, trying to find a radio. Up in my grandma's basement, sliding all the closet doors, trying to find a radio. And the homies say they heard a rap song, sounded like some folks they know, but we couldn't find a radio. The old me would drink a 40 and eat bologna, Shinobi on NBA Live. I played with Kobe. The OGs, I miss my old hood, miss my homies, it's lonely. The radio hosts, it's like they know me. The ocean, 50 seashells, that's how we're floating. Was hoping to hear.
What were you like in high school?
Depends on when we're talking. I came into it very lost. I was very lost in early in high school.
Did you get lost in middle school?
I got lost in the fourth grade when I got transferred out of the school I went to in the projects and went to school. I got bused to school on the north side of Chicago. I got lost that first day and didn't get unlost until like sophomore year of high school.
What was the feeling that you had when you got to the north side?
Just suddenly my identity just didn't exist. I just had no footing socially to build an identity off of. And so most of my memories in middle school and early high school was just kind of scrambling for something to hold on to.
Because you get there and you don't know the rules, basically?
Yeah, and it's a lot of it is like racial stuff. Like, I went from an all-black school to a mostly white school, and I think I experienced a lot of it through that lens at first, but in thinking back about it, it was a lot more about going from a poor school to a school where a lot of kids have money. And the combination of those two things, I just really never felt connected to any people there. And when I was, there was other people who seemed to be kind of oppressed by the whole thing, either economically or socially. I hung out with a lot of kids who were, like, super sad in the seventh grade when, like, Kurt Cobain died. You know what I mean? Like, I hung out with a lot of those. But also, you know, I played sports, so I had that. But I also wasn't cool enough to hang with those guys because they were, like, good with girls. And I had no idea what to do with a girl at that point in my life, you know. So just a lot of flailing, a lot of grabbing at straws until about midway through high school.
I remember that feeling in middle school of having gone. I went to a very fancy middle school from a not fancy context, and getting there and being like, "What are these people's lives?"
Yeah.
Like trying to figure out what they did after school. Mm. Like, who are these people? And they were all really nice, too. It wasn't even that. It was like, but what is the...
I remember a couple times literally hanging out with kids outside of school for the first time at that level and just being amazed. It was like Aladdin, like a whole new world. You know what I mean? It was just like kids hanging out in neighborhoods. Like, I had no conception of that. Like, I was very latchkey in my neighborhood because my neighborhood was hella dangerous. So there just was no conception of that at all.
What happened when you went to high school?
It really was, you know, as trite as it might be to say, man, it was discovering hip hop. It really did. It gave me access to this social world that was almost completely merit based. And that changed everything.
And like, when you say hip hop, you don't necessarily mean, wow, here's a distinction I've never vocally made on this program in the many years I've been doing it. You don't necessarily mean as a music, but as a culture.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm KRS-One. Yeah, but I mean, you mean like the as a creative scene.
Exactly. Like, I read this book called Bomb the Suburbs.
Oh, it's a great book.
Yeah.
Upski.
Upski's, yeah, I love Upski.
Shout out to Upski.
Shout out to Upski indeed. But that book really changed my life. Like, that book, a very strong thesis of that book was that you can't just listen to this music. You have to do this. If you don't do this, you're not hip hop. So that opened the doors of it being like, oh, like, I can do this. And then I would go be around people on the South Side who were doing the things, who were just like, they were kids going to high school just like me. Some of them were kids at my high school, and I didn't even realize they did this stuff until I saw them there. And I was like, oh, this is it, you know? So me and like four of these friends of mine, we all just like jumped into it head first at the same time and kind of built ourselves up inside of that by getting good at these things.
But you didn't at the time think, oh, look at that, I'm going to be Twister, Do or Die, or... those first national acts that were coming out of Chicago,
Crucial
or
Conflict.
Even Common?
Common was the most accessible one. But Rhymefest was a big deal for me. Like, Rhymefest was a guy who I would see at these places rapping. I battled Rhymefest once. Like, and I would listen to WHBK, which was the college station that had the three hip-hop shows that came on per week. They would get all the New York stuff, get all the West Coast underground stuff and play it. And he would be on there freestyling, you know, like, oh, my God, this guy, I know that guy, he's on the radio rapping. Oh, my goodness. And he was having projects come out that I could buy at the record store alongside Common and Lords of the Underground, whatever else I was buying at that time. And that is really kind of what opened it up. Like, the career path was unfolding that way, not like, you know, go to L.A. and get signed on Relativity Records or anything like that, you know.
We'll have more from Open Mike Eagle coming up. He was a school teacher, and he got laid off. And he had to sit down with his wife, and his wife basically just said, Mike, you got laid off from being a teacher. You're a rapper now. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and this message comes from 2020, where creatives get inspiring, authentic stock photos. Unlike traditional stage stock photos, 2020 has millions of real-world images your audience will actually engage with, all under a simple royalty-free license. Today, 2020 is offering Bullseye listeners a 7-day free trial of 5 photos. Monthly subscription begins after 7 days. To start your trial, go to 2020.com/bullseye. Hey, once you're done listening to Bullseye, check out this week's Car Talk podcast. It's where America turns for marital advice, psychological analysis, scientific theory, brotherly insults, and even some occasional car advice. If you need to feel better about the world, and don't we all, spend an hour with Click and Clack on this week's Car Talk podcast. Listen on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Open Mike Eagle. He's got a new album called Brick Body Kids Still Daydream. It's out now. He also co-hosts Maximum Fun's wrestling podcast, Tights and Fights. You graduated from college and went and got a job.
Yeah.
And so what was the point where you thought, I'm not going to be a guy with a job. I'm going to be a guy who makes music for a living?
I got laid off in 2009 from being a teacher.
And you were what, like 20 or 29 years old?
Yeah, I was 28, yeah.
So you're a grown-up.
Mm-hmm. That year, I also got my first record deal, though. So I got signed in, like, February or March of that year to my first, like, independent deal. I got laid off in the summer. That fall, I was supposed to go on a tour, my first tour, opening for Bus Driver and Abstract Rude. And when I got laid off, it was like a conversation at home with me and my wife, like, you know, I mean, I was driving home already thinking like I was going to, you know, go home, get on monster.com, get on idealist.org, start sending the resumes out again, you know, because the way that they had let me go was real. It was real kind of foul, too. Very unexpected. Like I had this like big stack of paperwork to do and they kind of just waited till it was all turned in and then let me go like the next day. It was really like ugly and it really hurt my feelings at the time. And so I was really down. But yeah, she was like, no, you should just get on unemployment and try out the music thing. I was like, for real? And she said, yeah, she was all for it. And, you know, being on unemployment wasn't an easy thing to do at first because of pride and, you know, you have to lie on the forms about how many jobs you apply to every couple of weeks or whatever. But yeah, I did that and... You know, it did give me just enough buffer time, though, to figure out, especially in the waning independent music economy, like how to start bringing money in. And it was a good 2-3 year long process to go from when I would go out of town to do shows and be guaranteed to be losing money to like now I'm like living off of that.
Do you think that you could have done that if you weren't married at the time?
Probably not. Because, you know, the unemployment wasn't enough. I don't think it would have been enough to have a decent apartment somewhere. I'd had to live with somebody. I would have needed some support from somewhere. And I never really had support, like family support like that before my wife.
Let's hear some more music from my guest open Mike Eagle's new album called Brick Body Kids, Still Daydream. Let's hear a little bit of No Selling.
Gotta keep a facade, I gotta play it cool. Like when you were the girl and she could wake at school. Gonna get the leather shirt, my stomach never hurts. Strong face, strong jaw shown to my competitors. I tear my ACL and wouldn't even limp. I keep my head up high so I can read the blimps. Don't even scream if something hot burns my fingertips. I just wait a couple seconds then I reattempt. I had a real childhood, my truth was wildhood. But crying ain't my style cause I can smile good. I don't take shit personal, I don't get jealous. You can leave my name off, you can misspell it. I ain't with yelling, I ain't even mad. I ain't screaming, catching feelings.
So that song about you? It's in the first person.
Yeah, but it's that song is the song's called No Selling. And No Selling is a pro wrestling term.
I figured. I didn't know what it meant, but I thought that's probably a pro wrestling term.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, when
I know about baby faces.
Right. Now, yeah. And it's No Selling is something a baby face does typically when they're making their comeback in a match. So let's say Hulk Hogan is fighting Iron Sheik and Iron Sheik is just beating his tail the entire match. Let's say it's a 20-minute match, 15-minute mark. Iron Sheik goes for something, and Hogan shakes it off and stares at him like it didn't hurt. That's called no selling, and that's how he starts his offense because that's how, you know, the crowd gets back into a match emotionally. It's like, oh, the good guy, he's found some inner strength. But I protracted that in the song to all the instances where we kind of have to do that in life, where like you feel something, but because of the situation or because it's somehow advantageous for you, you put out some other reality of what you're going through. You don't sell pain. And that just interests me in a kind of PTSD sort of way. And that kind of tied into the theme of the album and stuff through all of that.
Was your career success so incremental that you...
That was the perfect word for it, by the way. The best adjective ever to describe my career.
Did that leave you without crisis points where you thought this will never work? Or did it reinforce crisis points where you thought this will never work?
I never think that it'll never work because it's already working. My crisis point every day is always like, is this a mistake? So I'm really high stressed right now, right? Because I got a new album. I dropped one single and people like it. You know, I got another one coming any moment now. And I'm like, is this a mistake? You know, and the thing is, a mistake for me doesn't end everything. It just makes everything a little bit harder for a while until I do something else that's not a mistake. But the whole time, like, I tend to do so much in, like, you know, different fields that it all tends to be okay. You know, like nothing. The times where I thought it maybe wouldn't work was like that first tour I went on, because I agreed to go on that tour for no money in my own car. Only, just had like these $5 CDs I was selling. And I was like, by the time we got up to Vancouver, I was like, I don't know about the rest of these dates. This is scary business. I like got a hotel on hotels.com, and I was in a street called Hastings Street in Vancouver. Do you know about that place? You couldn't have told me it wasn't the meth capital of the world. These hotel rooms were not used for people sleeping. They were used for people to rent and do meth. Hotels.com didn't want to tell me that, though. They wanted me to give my money to this person. It was like, you want to sleep here? He was surprised at the...
Frank, get a bed.
Right? Oh, yeah. So, you know, my moments of crisis were more about physical danger than they were about the endeavor not really working. Because even when it works, it's not like... I don't make millions. I don't make a ton of money. Like I live according to my means with music. I don't get large budgets to make albums with. I don't get large budgets to do anything with. And I get that because I don't make fully sellable music. I don't do that. You know, like that's not really what I'm doing it for. You know, so like my continued existence every day is a victory in some sense. That's what I was saying earlier. Like I'm kind of always aware of it. You know,
when you were in high school in 1997 and even when you were out of college in 2004, being weird in hip hop was a really specific and narrow lane. Mm-hmm. It was a tough row to hoe. Mm-hmm. You know, you moved out to L.A. to be weird.
Yeah.
And there was some roots of weirdness here.
It was definitely less weird than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be so much weirder.
But like, really, I mean, you were looking at a group of, I don't know, 20 people being weird, mm-hmm. 40 people maybe, you know what I mean? Or including producers and stuff, yeah, you know?
For sure.
And now as we sit here in 2017, one of the really amazing things about hip hop is that some of the most successful rappers in the world
are just the strangest birds walking.
Very weird. Mm-hmm. And very much, I mean, you couldn't find a more project bloaty 27-year-old in the world than Kendrick Lamar.
Right. Absolutely.
You know? You couldn't find a more weird, personal, insane group of rappers than Odd Future.
Yeah. Kanye's crazy. You know, it's...
Yeah, well, I mean, Kanye is sort of... I mean, I think one of the great gifts of Kanye West to the world is that he came out wearing a backpack making Jay-Z records.
Right. I mean...
And it didn't start out being a Louis Vuitton backpack.
I used to call my stuff art rap. That was a very reactionary term to there being zero weirdness in the market landscape at that time.
Well, as we talked about, I mean, the sort of the left of center lane mm-hmm. was completely dominated by I'm defending real hip hop, or I'm revolutionary in this way. Mm-hmm. And both of those are very, I mean, they both have made a lot of great music, but they're both narrow lanes. There's not a lot, you know, there's a lot of orthodoxy in those worlds.
I mean, and then, you know, so Lil Wayne happened.
Yeah.
And he is a very weird dude. And he started making, like, his biggest records. He had songs about him being an alien. Like, legit weird. He made Cool Keith-type songs in terms of the conceit in which the song was written around. So that was big. I think that opened up the lane for Kanye to be as weird as he wanted to be. And I think that Watch the Throne record, that's a very art rap album. And like, and it was literal in that sense, because they're actually talking about a lot of like visual art and paintings and stuff. But then like
Jay-Z definitely takes it very literally.
Yeah. But you know, it was a high expression of rap that was completely out of the bounds of the street expectation. And that, I think, you know, those things in concert are kind of what opened up, you know, the lanes for everybody to be as strange as they want. Now you can have a Young Thug in a dress doing crazy rap styles, and he's, you know, one of the biggest artists in the world, you know, and manages to maintain all of the street cred, which you used to have to forego to do weird stuff.
Ghetto in the way I drink, uncle, my ship sank. Ghetto in the way I think, have my troubles, my don't stink. Ghetto in the way I move, watch me groove, how I say my blues. Ghetto in the way I talk. My auntie still give God the glory, shot by the book depository. Never heard one of grandfather's stories, permanent sadness, constant mourning. 22 grandkids, one apartment, turn the stove.
I want to ask you about professional wrestling for a minute before we're completely out of time.
Sure.
You're the co-host of a podcast that records in this very studio.
In this room.
Called Tights and Fights. It's about professional wrestling.
I wanted to go sit in my seat over there. You told me.
And I don't understand what's good about professional wrestling.
That's interesting that you don't.
I know enough people that I trust.
So you know that there's something there.
I know there's something there. And I mean, there's plenty of things that, I mean, nobody that I know understands why I like Babe 2, Babe Pig in the City as much as I do. So, so for people who have never had a second thought about professional wrestling, what is it that appeals to you, a college-educated professional smart man?
Let's take Vince McMahon, for instance.
Vince McMahon is the owner of the WWE, the big wrestling conglomerate.
He's not just the owner, though.
He's also a performer.
And he's the head booker, which means he's the head writer. He has been writing wrestling television angles, storylines for performers every week of his life for the past 30 years. Like, there's no off-season. 52 weeks a year, they go out there in front of a packed arena, and these characters, a lot of times he's created or he's developed, go out there and try to do things that they think people are going to care about. And sometimes they care, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes there's these magical moments of a character going out there and improvising something that defines their career for the next 10 years. And sometimes somebody goes out there and does exactly what Vince and the writing staff has written for them to say, and it gets over, and they use this term, gets over like a fart in church. Nothing happens, and some guys end up on a scrap heap. Some guys get fired because they're not getting over. Then they go to the independents and find some new gimmick and come back, and then they're made champion within a year because they figured it out. You know, it's live entertainment. It's choreography. It's so emotional. It's so emotional. And it's their job to predict what we're going to feel as fans, to try to be in front of that. A lot of times they're wrong, but when they get it right, it's really incredible. When you can see an arena full of 20,000 adults that all know this is fake entertainment, all have a real emotional moment where they're like happy for a character who has been beaten down for 6 weeks and finally figured out some way to defeat the villain. You know, it is, I think it's a very substantive form of entertainment that ends up with a lot of crass elements just based on how often it has to be delivered.
And I think that it's, you know, because it's built essentially around physical violence.
Yeah, absolutely.
And physical pain.
Absolutely. I mean, even the story of how it came to be is crazy. I mean, it used to be legitimate professional wrestling competition until like three or four guys who ran it figured out that if they built a certain guy up to win, then they could make more money. And then it was just a secret that it was faked. that the, you know, like the referees didn't even know for years. And then, you know, the story of it becoming what it is now, where like most of the people are fully aware that it's a work and still engaging in it. It's like this really incredible form of entertainment that works on like all of these levels. To me, it's just absolutely fascinating.
It's not that what you are describing is not that wildly what you're describing is not that wildly different from the aesthetic of hip hop.
Right.
That hip hop is about the relationship between a character and reality, and a storyline in reality, the tension between those things.
Right.
In a way that, like, when people say it's like a soap opera is a sort of grand fictional form, but it's purely fictional. And it seems like, to me, as an outsider, part of the juice of professional wrestling is the weird relationship between the fiction and the reality.
Right. I mean, in a lot of these cases, your name could be Joe Anoa'i. Vince McMahon or somebody underneath him decides to name you Roman Reigns, and that is now your name. Like, nobody's going to call you Joe in the street. They're going to call you Roman, and you're going to answer to it because that is who you are now. Like, you can't take Roman Reigns as a gimmick and now put him on a different person. You can't do it because Roman Reigns is that guy. He's not this other guy, you know? And it's like the same with a rapper, right? Like, you can't take Open Mike Eagle as a gimmick and look and then just put it on somebody else. Like, no, there's an authenticity that ends up happening where the human merges with the gimmick or the rap name or whatever it is, and now those are one. They're like inseparable that way.
We'll wrap up my conversation with Open Mike Eagle after a quick break. Plus, still to come, the great Paula Poundstone. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and this message comes from NBC, featuring the premiere of Megyn Kelly Today, a new morning show offering exclusive interviews, stories to inspire you, and the day's top news, along with thought-provoking conversation. If you're in the New York area and want to attend a live show, visit today.com/mktodayaudience. Megyn Kelly Today, weekdays at 9 a.m. on NBC. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We'll get back to my conversation with Open Mike Eagle in just a minute. But first, if you love Bullseye's film coverage, our in-depth conversations with filmmakers and stuff, well, I've got great news for you. We've got a new sister show here at MaximumFun.org that's all about the movies. It's called Who Shot Ya? It features the brilliant and hilarious stand-up comedian Ricky Carmona hosting, along with April Wolfe and Alonso Duralde, who are brilliant film critics. And it is a sharp, woke conversation about what's going on in movies this week. They run through the news and then they get in-depth on a movie or a topic that's come up. It is really fun, really funny, and actually genuinely insightful. They are three brilliant human beings. I can't recommend it enough. So give it a try. It's easy. Just open up your podcatching software and search for Who Shot Ya, the new film podcast from MaximumFun.org. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the rapper Open Mike Eagle. His latest album, Brick Body Kids Still Daydream, is out now. You know, hip-hop is this kind of identity play where you are choosing and asserting your place in the world.
Yeah.
In all its forms. Screaming it. Mm-hmm. In all its forms. Not just in music, but most obviously, you know, or most famously in music. That you're like saying, I am this guy, mm-hmm. whether or not you are that guy. And in a way, like, what it's about is whether you can, as you said in wrestling parlance, put it over, right?
Get over. Yeah.
Get over.
Yeah. With you.
Right.
Get
like,
over,
it's not really about how, like, what's real about it helps make it work.
Right.
But at the same time, nobody was mad at Rick Ross for being a gangster rapper who was actually a corrections officer because that just makes it more fun.
Right. No, it's, you know, for the people, there were people who were mad, but they got drowned out by the people who were just, I mean, there's a lot of people who listen to Rick Ross who never listen to a word of what he says. Rick Ross is where he's at mostly because he picks the best beats ever. You know what I mean?
But he has a grand vision of who he is in the world.
Of course.
And that people feel that.
Absolutely. People feel it. And people feel like his image, everything he does, he upholds it. And he lives his gimmick, like the Undertaker. He lives his gimmick. Like, you're not going to catch Rick Ross out of character. You know what I mean? He lives his gimmick. And that, you do have to do that on that level. You can't really have too much separation. And the thing is, like that's the difference between a character like that and a character like me. Like, I'm actively choosing in most senses not to play a character, but that also limits how much I can get over. Because, like, it would be like, you know, if my name was Joe Jackson, not the singer, but, you know, and I wanted to be a wrestler and I didn't want to put on a gimmick. You know, and I wanted people to take me seriously as, and then sooner or later that becomes your gimmick. But that also is the thing when people are looking like, what are you doing, dude? Like, this is not for regular people. This is for larger than life people. What are you doing? You know, and I'm kind of walking on that. I'm kind of doing that thing. Like, I think that there's enough validity to people being themselves that they don't necessarily have to put on a costume to make, like, effective rap music. And I think that, like, that's part of what that's the limitation put on rap music that's not put on other things. And it bothers me and it offends me sometimes, you know, that, like, in other genres of entertainment, people aren't expected to be such an over-the-top thing. Like in other genres of entertainment, their mere existence and their talent is all they need. And I feel like that's ultimately, when I say art rap, like, that's what I mean, you know. And people like me and Serengeti and Bus Driver and Milo, and, you know, we come from this long lineage of people, but I feel like in the end of the day, we're like trying to assert the worth of our own humanity in rap music. Like, that's where the fight is. And that's why, like, I can't, there's no person for me to fight because I'm fighting that, you know? And the only way to, like, the only way to advance is to do that and manage to do it in a way that connects, that people can connect to, that people can somehow, like, to be so self-indulgent that it becomes relatable.
Well, Open Mike Eagle, thanks for taking the time to be on Bullseye.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a dream of mine.
Great to have this conversation. I'm glad that you finally achieved your dream of being on NPR.
I'm so happy.
Open Mike Eagle, go listen to his new record, Brick Body Kids Still Daydream. It's available to buy and stream right now. And if you liked his wrestling hot takes, I've got great news for you. You can hear even more of that on the podcast he co-hosts, Tights and Fights. It's part of our very own Maximum Fun Network. We'll have more information about that on the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org, or you can just search for Tights and Fights, your podcast software. Let's take a listen to one more song from Mike's new album. It's called Legendary Iron Hood.
Black time got style, Abbott Poole, got a brother named Charles, if you on that boot. I protect my neck with some magical jewels. It can't none of y'all take them from me. Yeah, yeah. And Cortez, cause I feel like fate. Again, my fit got a head like the dome of a state. Again, you think it's all good, but it's really get great. Again, bag it now, ladies in the clearly Canadian. Yeah, don't turn away from me. Look at my eye hole. My brother got heart, but he running with psychos. He always got a gang with him, hella disciples. They always trying to fight, though, but I stay cool. I can't lose no argument. I got my jewels. I keep my head down, pushing like I'm walking to school. Yeah, I hold them tight like infinity. Jim, policeman, looking at me like I'm finna be him. No, my daddy gives a hard man, my mother's a ghost.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Artists, the people who make stuff, are often influenced by the stuff they see or hear. And sometimes that thing is so great they wish they made it themselves. It happens so often we made a segment about it. It's called I Wish I'd Made That. Today, you're going to hear from Paula Poundstone. She's a legendary stand-up comedian, been in the game since 1979. She's appeared on pretty much every talk show. She's had recurring roles on TV, dozens of specials. But this is NPR, and we're talking about Paula Poundstone. So we're talking about Paula Poundstone of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Paula, this week a bus driver in India was reprimanded for failing to collect a ticket from a passenger, even though the passenger was what?
Even though the passenger was a dog.
Close.
A bird.
Yes. What kind of bird?
A parrot.
Yeah, back up. More common.
A pigeon.
Yes, a pigeon. I'm amazed you knew that.
Of course I knew that.
These days, Paula's working on a bunch of other new stuff, too. She's hosting a podcast called Live from the Poundstone Institute, where she interviews experts and academics in front of a live studio audience. She's also the author of a new book called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. In it, she explores and tries out pretty much every trick in the book to live a happier life. Stuff like Taekwondo, reorganizing her house, and driving a fancy new car. When we asked her if there was any TV show or movie that she wishes she'd made, she had a quick answer. Bridesmaids from 2011. Maybe one of the best wedding movies ever? Anyway, take it away, Paula.
The first time I saw Bridesmaids, I saw it in a movie theater with my two daughters who were, you know, probably one was early 20s and one was a teenager. I did not want to go see it. I don't know why I knew this, but I knew it was like related to somehow this sort of frat humor kind of movies that sometimes don't do anything for me. I knew that it would be like a little bit gross. And I just said to myself, you know, I don't know. It's just not my type of humor, I said. But all my ideas about how I wouldn't enjoy it pretty much fell away in the first scene. The scene of the character Annie, the Kristen Wiig character, having sex with the really boyfriend was so damn funny. It's all about her trying to sexually please this guy, and she was so damn funny in it. Her legs sort of dangling about. I'm not usually like a huge sexual comedy kind of a character, but this was just so... It's, you know, Kristen Wiig just did it so brilliantly.
You slept over.
I did.
I thought we had a rule against that.
Oh.
I'm kidding.
Oh. That was funny. You're funny in the morning.
Wow, this is so awkward. I really want you to leave, but I don't know how to say it without sounding like a...
Probably the most notorious scene in Bridesmaids is the one where they are... they've gone into the very fancy wedding gown place, you know, by appointment only, and everything is all white.
Belle and Blanc, reservation name?
Oh, I don't have one. We're just here to shop, just to try on some dresses.
Okay, well, the next available appointment for bridesmaids fittings is in 7 weeks. Absolutely no walk-in.
And then they all have food poisoning, and they proceed to throw up and have uncontrolled bowel movements as a result. I mean, that alone would honestly not have done that much for me. But it was just what they were saying while it was happening that made it like, you know, a cut above.
You know, I don't really care which dress we get. It doesn't matter to me. I just need to get off this white carpet.
No, okay. God. No, not the bathroom. Oh, everybody, God. Go outside. I'm serious. There's a bathroom across the street.
Oh, I think we have to talk about the plane scene. Because one of the funniest lines in the movie ever said was in the plane scene.
I'm not a good flyer, I'm sorry. I had a dream last night that we went down. Yep, it was terrible. You were in it.
What?
Oh, God. Sounds like something's happening.
The character that the Annie character is very much in competition with is Helen. Helen has usurped, or appears to have usurped, Annie's role as the best friend of the bride. And this is, during the story, is that, you know, everything just keeps getting worse, but the biggest problem is that her friendship with her best friend is coming apart. So they're on their way to Las Vegas for the bachelorette party, and Annie's afraid to fly. And she's also broke. And her rival, the Helen character, is rich. So the Helen character is sitting in first class with the best friend, the bride. And Annie comes up to say, oh, I'm so nervous about flying. And the Helen character offers her some sort of, you know, relaxant.
I have something. Take two, you'll fall asleep, wake up, and we'll be there. Here.
Oh, ma'am, you're going to have to return to your seat, please.
And then she says, well, these aren't doing anything. And so the Helen character suggests to her that she wash it down with some whiskey. And so there's, a powerful combination of inebriants now working.
doing?
I'm good. I'm so much more relaxed. Thank you, Helen. I just feel like I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party with the best of them. And I'm gonna go down to the river.
And so Annie makes her way up again to first class, where the really snooty first class flight attendant, a guy named Steve, tells her that she has to go back to her seat.
What do you say?
Miss, you cannot be up here.
Hello, Grandpa.
This is a very strict plane that I'm on. Welcome to Germany.
As she walks back to the seat, first class has the silly curtains that go in between first class and the rest of the plane. And she opens the first class curtains and she says,
this should be open because it's civil rights. This is the 90s.
Right. It's not. You're in the wrong decade.
You are.
Okay, I am.
You are.
Thank you.
Holy what did you give her?
So brilliant. So funny. And then, I don't know, Mitch Silpa is the guy who plays Steve. And I must say, part of what was funny, as in so many comedy performances, part of what was funny was how good Mitch Silpa was at being an
Miss?
No, it's not me.
Yes, it is you. Please go back to your seat.
Yes, I'm with him. I'm Mrs. Iglesias.
No, you're not. You were just out here and you put sunglasses on. Out.
But I don't want to.
Sir, everybody go back to your seats.
Okay, you especially. You have 3 seconds to get back to your seat.
Oh, you can't get anywhere in 3 seconds.
Well, you better try.
You're setting me up for a loss already.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, part of what was joyous about that cast and those performances were just sort of how far they were willing to go. You know, the scene with Melissa McCarthy, who comes in and Annie is depressed on her couch and hasn't, you know, gotten up and functioned for days.
I don't have any friends. The last time I find
interesting about that, Annie? Here's a friend standing directly in front of you trying to talk to you, and you choose to talk about the fact that you don't have any friends.
You know what I
no.
mean?
Nope. I don't think you want any help. That's I think you want to have a little pity party.
No.
Yeah, I think Annie wants a little pity party. Is that what you want?
And Melissa McCarthy starts wrestling her in this sort of psychodrama where she's pretending to be Annie's life.
Ow! Annie.
My God, what are you doing?
I'm life, huh? Life bothering you?
I was a teenager in the 70s, so this part, and I was a screwed up teenager. So this, this sort of psychodrama way of healing or breaking through is not unfamiliar to me, which is part of what made it so damn funny.
And you won't do it. You just won't do it. You stop slapping yourself. Stop slapping yourself. I'm your life, Annie. I'm your life. Sorry. Nice hit.
I've never been a bridesmaid, and I would never want to be one. I've occasionally gone to weddings, but that's as far as I can go. It doesn't sound like fun at all to me. You know, weddings cause problems. So the story is about the build-up to the wedding, not specifically about the wedding, but a lot of the problems that are caused by weddings, I think, are during the build-up. It's always somehow the guest list offends somebody. Somebody wasn't on the guest. There's just always problems with weddings. I don't know why people have them.
You know what? Why can't you just be happy for me and then go home and talk behind my back later like a normal person?
I am happy for you, Lillian. I am very happy for you. I wish you well. I won't bother you anymore.
Kidding me? Annie! Get back here! Stop! No, no! She does not get a party favor! She does not get a dog!
Oddly, even though people tend to think of it as the movie where, you know, they throw up and have uncontrollable bowel movements at one scene, it is layered.
Alan just took over everything, and this has been really hard to do without you.
I'm sorry.
Nope, I'm sorry. Sorry I kicked you out of my wedding. It's my fault.
No, it's my fault. I think I'm the one with the mental problems.
Yeah, wasn't it my turn to be crazy?
Yes.
The bride's supposed to be crazy,
technically,
right? You kind of stole all the crazy.
I out-crazied you.
If I was trying to talk somebody going into this movie, I would simply say that I, in my opinion, it's the funniest movie ever made. I wish they would do a remake of it and have me in it this time.
Paula Poundstone on The Thing She Wishes She'd Made, the 2011 movie Bridesmaids, starring Kristen Wiig, Maya Rudolph, and Melissa McCarthy. Paula's new podcast, Live from the Poundstone Institute, is up and going strong. Check it out on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts. Every week we like to wrap things up on Bullseye with a recommendation from me. It's the Outshot. I'm going to tell you about my favorite thing. And I want you to know that this is not a fancy thing or a classy thing. This is a dumb thing. My favorite thing is a baseball card. It sits on my bookshelf. I can actually see it from where I'm sitting right now. It's from the 1989 Fleer set, one that came out right when I was the most obsessed with baseball and the most obsessed with baseball cards. And it was the holy grail back then. Billy Ripken, 1989 Fleer, number 616. Baseball cards and baseball card collecting are about order and completism. Tables of statistics, four sharp corners, finishing off sets. But some of the cards that people want the most are the ones that break that order. Error cards, ones with mistakes that were quickly corrected, like that upside-down airplane stamp that's worth so much money. And in the history of error cards, this is by far the best one. The error's pretty small. You have to look carefully to see it. I guess that's how it slipped through. I mean, it's like a few millimeters square. And the one that I had in childhood, over the error, there was a black box, like a literal opaque black box right over the knob of Billy Ripken's bat. Before the black box, which was pretty easy to find, there was one with just a scribble on it from a correction pen, and there was one with a white box. But I'm a grown-up now, and I've got the original, and it is near and dear to my heart. Because why did they put that scribble there, and then the white box, and then the black box? Why did they cover up the knob of Billy Ripken's bat? Because before Ripken headed out to the field in spring training for someone to take his official portrait, somebody took a Sharpie to the knob of his bat. And so the base of the bat in his official baseball card photograph has face written on it. I mean, I'm literally laughing right now just thinking about it. It isn't even a joke. It's just a swear word written in Sharpie on a baseball bat. But just picture it. There's this guy, handsome, smiling, all-American, right there on his bat knob. It says face. And then they put it on his baseball card. I mean, did Billy Ripken do it? Did one of his teammates, a clubhouse guy, the photographer, his brother, Hall of Famer Cal Ripken? Who cares? Best baseball card ever. It says face on it. Look, I am a great appreciator of order. I am a rule follower. But it's nice to have a reminder that sometimes it can be fun to give order and rules the old purple nurple. That's my Outshot. That's all for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Something pretty amazing happened this week on the lake. Somebody was racing a fancy remote-controlled speedboat out there. Not something you see every day. Certainly not something that the wildlife sees every day. They were not crazy about it. Sick wake, though. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He had help from Christian Duenas and Casey O'Brien. Our production fellows here at MaximumFun.org are Nick Liao and Khalid Malim. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our theme music was recorded by the Go Team and provided to us by Memphis Industries Records. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And while you're at it, check out the Bullseye page on Facebook. We've got a bunch more info about the show there, links to dumb stuff on the internet. Like, for example, I just posted a video of Oasis's Liam Gallagher making a cup of tea and swearing a lot. It's great. I don't even like Oasis. I guess that's about it. Just remember, All great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.